12 Education, Policy Division, actually. This is the first time that we've had a Policy Division sorted out, because actually, as I mentioned earlier, legislation kind of comes to us in two different forms, one through the Finance Division and one through the Policy. So, but welcome Senator Saxhog and our guests. And this morning we're talking about early childhood initiatives, and then we also will deal with Senate File 72, which is a Senator Clark's legislation. So I'm going to turn it over to Senator Saxhog.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We're kind of fresh out of an inspiring session last night, the Early Childhood Summit that was bicameral and bipartisan. I think it went over very well. It was held in the House Chambers, and the keynote for that particular summit was David Lawrence, who's a nationally known early childhood advocate, former publisher of the Miami Herald for about 35 years. And he was very interesting and very inspiring. And after that, we got to the local talent, and I consider local talent to be Jim Houlihan from the Blanner Foundation. So that's Itasca County, but I think Minnesota's local talent, too. This committee a couple of years ago, as you know, Mr. Chair, I think came to the conclusion that if we're ever going to do anything to improve our situation with special education, it's got to come through investment in early childhood. And so we have a group today who we wanted to find someone who could show us that investing in early childhood would actually work. And that's what Itasca County, with the help of the Blanner Foundation, has done. And with me today is Jim Houlihan from the Blanner Foundation and his team from Invest Early, including the head of the team, Mary Kosak. And Jim's going to make some introductions here, and then we're going to proceed with the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Senator Saxon. Welcome, Mr. Houlihan.
Thank you.
Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Jim Houlihan, and I am president of the Blandin Foundation, located in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I had, as Senator Saxhog mentioned, the opportunity to speak yesterday to members of the Senate and the House. It went for about 15 minutes, and I can tell you, honestly, I've already been asked this morning, now you're not going to speak that long again, are you? And the answer was no. My remarks really will be very brief, and that is to mention that the Blanner Foundation is located in Itasca County in Grand Rapids and have been there for over 60 years. We are privileged to be the stewards of Mr. Blanner's legacy and his resources. He was a publisher of the Pioneer Press and owner of the Blanner Paper Mill in Grand Rapids. And with his assets, we strive to accomplish our mission, which is to strengthen rural communities throughout all of Minnesota, but especially in our home communities in the Grand Rapids area. So what's a foundation doing in early childhood? Because among the things that the foundation does to strengthen communities is to make grants to organizations like the Performing Arts Center, the YMCA. We do leadership training, and we do public policy and engagement. The answer is we're involved in early childhood development in a very significant way because it's about healthy community. It fits squarely in our mission. And when we go one level below that, it's our belief that early childhood development not only is about healthy community, but it's got a justice piece to it and an economic development piece to it. And what you'll hear shortly from Mary Kosak, as Senator Saxhog mentioned, are the details of that program, how it works and what we think is the secret sauce. It's a word we keep using because we think it is about something that's not too complicated, but it's different than and more than the money. And I'd hate to tell you the secret sauce now because then you might not listen to Mary. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for your time, energy, and leadership in this critical area.
Thank you very much, Mr. Houlihan. Ms. Kozak?
Mr. Chair, Senators, and guests, my name is Mary Kozak, and I work at the Blandin Foundation. Thank you for your invitation to share with you today the story of Invest Early. I won't thank you, though, with putting me on today, having to follow what happened yesterday at the Legislative Summit. That was a tough act to follow, and believe me, I did not sleep well last night. But I am honored to say that I have been involved with Invest Early since its birth. There are three others, Jan Reindl, Maureen Rosato, and Sue Heft, that are here today and have also been with Invest Early since the beginning. Invest Early is an initiative that is a little over 3 years old. The classroom doors opened in October 2005, so it is currently in its fourth year of operation. That does not include the research, planning, and design years, however. As the slide says, let's start at the beginning. This first photo shows the superintendent of the Grand Rapids School District holding a couple of Invest Early babies. This is not an unusual occurrence, since five of the Invest Early classrooms are located in the ISD 318 administration building. Something you might find interesting is the fact that this school district used the entire amount given to them from the state of Minnesota's Iron Range Resources School Bond Grant Funds to remodel space in the administration to allow for the early childhood classrooms. This gives you an indication of the support that our administrators have given to this initiative. Now, I won't spend a whole lot of time describing the project since Jim did a pretty good job yesterday at the Legislative Summit, but I will touch on the important points and describe some of our preliminary three-year results. Our goal is to partner with families and early childhood programs in order to provide the best possible start for all children. Key word here, partner. The mission is to deliver comprehensive wraparound services to children and their families while we evaluate the long-term impact of the investment. Key word here, comprehensive. When you hear of all the partners involved in the services provided, you will realize the needs of the whole child are being met, as well as the family needs. The main partners are Kutaska Head Start, all four school districts, the early childhood development programs in all four of Itasca County school districts, Itasca County Public Health, and Itasca Community College. And something that I should point out is that representatives from all of these groups come together every month for at least a four-hour meeting in what's called the Invest Early Leadership Team meeting. So every single month. And then that leadership team also has, like, subcommittees, you know, finance team, school transition team, hiring team, intake team, you know, nuts and bolts team even. They deal with all of the nitty-gritty little details from the day-to-day operations. And these people on the Invest Early leadership team are the ones that are really on the floor working with all of the children and families. They're not the higher-up, superintendents, administrators. They're the people on the ground literally running the program. The supporting partners, as you can see, quite a few here. And what I did want to point out is that some of the Invest Early dollars from the Blandin Grant are used for purchased service agreements with some of these partners. For example, they contract with Adult Basic Ed. They contract with Children's Mental Health. And another interesting point I thought I'd bring up is the first time I ever brought Jim Houlihan to one of the Invest Early classrooms, I introduced him to this gentleman rocking a baby in a rocking chair. And, you know, they were very cordial and everything. And then later on, after we left the building, I pointed out to Jim that man in the rocking chair, Jim thought it was either a grandpa or a volunteer. I said, oh, no, that was a children's mental health specialist. He was in there doing some observations. So again, you can see how these groups work together, and they do it in such a way that it's not obtrusive. It's just very, very natural. Our core services are the classrooms themselves, infant and toddler classrooms, preschool classrooms, the parent ed, the health services, and the home visits. This year, there are currently 18 classrooms. 13 of them are preschool, and 5 of them are infant toddler classrooms. The home visits, I want to point out that there's a minimum of 2 home visits per year per child. Health services, thought I would mention to you that they contract with the school district school nurses and the public health nurses to provide about 7 to 10 hours a week of services with the children and families. And to give you an example of how it's helped, there was one child who had been having problems. The school nurse looked at him, discovered he had some kind of an ear problem, asked the parents, you know, have you seen a doctor lately? And they said, well, we've been trying for, you know, the last week or two. But the car situation, we just have the one car, and the person who had to go to work had to take the car. The other one couldn't take the time have the transportation to get to the clinic to have their child seen by the doctor. The school nurse immediately called the clinic, arranged for an appointment, called a taxi, sent them off to the clinic. Now think about an instance like this where it could have been turned into, who knows, you know, a possible lifelong hearing problem for the child had they continued to ignore it. There's also what we call a menu of additional services. These are the services where not all the families need or want them, but they are available. So adult basic ed, there might be a parent that needs work on obtaining their GED. The extended care is available 5 days a week, 12 months of year of the year, and it's 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So even though the programming part, you know, is the normal hours, that's 6 a.m. to, say, 8:30 p.m., and then the 3 to 6 is on the other end, so that, say, a parent is going to college or working and needs those additional hours, they're available. Family development, I'll mention that a little bit more later. 4 sites throughout Itasca County. These 18 classrooms are located in all 4 sites that actually make up the 4 school districts in Itasca County. This, I won't read everything, but this is showing you what all of the early childhood classes provide. You will notice, you know, a key component of quality, the licensed instructors and providers. The Invest Early unique features. Here's where we could probably spend hours in discussion. Like Jim Houlihan mentioned yesterday, these features are really our secret sauce. And by the way, the ingredients for our secret sauce, take one community aware of the importance of early childhood education, mix with several quality early care providers, add a healthy dash of partnership and collaborative experience, cream together some funds, and sprinkle all over with passion, enthusiasm, and dedication to children and families. The first one there, one common application. When a family needs early care and education for their child, they can go to any school district office or any building that houses a Head Start classroom and pick up an application. It is seamless for the families. They turn in the application, and a team from the partnership figures out the funding stream that will provide programming for the child. The blended classrooms, that's maybe a term that wouldn't immediately resonate with people. What it means to us is a classroom that has a combination of kids that are being funded through Head Start dollars, kids that are being funded through school readiness dollars, and children that are being funded through the Invest Early Blandin Grant dollars. There could also be a Head Start teacher teaching side-by-side with a school district teacher, or a teacher funded through the Invest Early dollars. This is what we mean by blended classrooms. The parents have no clue, you know, who's funding what. The children have no idea. These kids are all blended in these classrooms, and it's just kind kind of a beautiful thing to see. Another important point, every kindergarten student in our county is given the kindergarten readiness assessment. And as you are probably all well aware, about, what, 10% of the state of Minnesota kindergartners are being assessed that. So you have data, but we have 100% data on our kids. Every infant and toddler is assessed using the ounce scale, and every preschooler is assessed using work sampling. And work sampling is what the state of Minnesota commonly uses with in the kindergarten readiness assessment. Another thing that's unique, the data tracker position. And anybody who has seen our video, Lori Camilli is an absolute hoot when she's standing there with, you know, piles and piles of work, and she goes, "I'm the data tracker. I collect data, volumes of data." And it is true. In fact, do you have the data collection plan in your folders? It was a one-page handout. It was in addition. One other one. It says data collection plan. That's it. Senator Bob, if you don't mind holding it up so they see. That gives you an idea of everything that is being collected. There is a very prescribed system for when this information is collected, when it's sent off to Wilder. I mean, when she says volumes, she means volumes. And if you talked to Wilder Research, they would certainly agree with that as well. Customized database, it was developed locally, and that's what is used to enter in a lot of the information as well as parent surveys. Countywide staff development and training plan. Again, I have a portfolio here that has all of that in it. It not only has all of the forms and the whole infrastructure of the project, but if I whipped out the development and training plan, I think you'd be absolutely amazed to see how many people are reached. And the fact that what they've done is, rather than every single silo having their own individual training and all of their own development pieces, what they've done is they've brought the entire county together in this training plan. And you can see how dollars would be saved by doing that. The evaluation, as I mentioned, Wilder Research is doing it for us. It is a longitudinal and cost benefits evaluation. They are measuring three aspects in three different or outcomes in three different ways. They're measuring our systems change, they're measuring our families, and they're measuring the children outcomes. And the last bullet there, this is exactly what's happening right now. We're trying to give to you some of our data. We've also met with several school districts throughout the last few years who have been interested and want to hear more. How are you doing this? What do we need to do to do something similar? The next slide is on the demographics. This shows you exactly how many children ages 0 to 5 are participating, how many families, the percentage of the years. And if you look at the age 2 and younger, those are the kids who would be receiving absolutely no services except for the invest early dollars. So, and then the 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, of course, as I mentioned, we have those blended streams of dollars. It shows the boys and girls. It shows our the demographics of our racial diversity, which, as you know, in Minnesota is not, especially in Itasca County, we don't have much diversity, but we still have at least a representative sampling in our project. The median income, as you can see, is quite low, and one of the risk factors, single-parent families. We do take in children with the highest number of risk factors first. They're the ones who get priority. As many of you know, that's what the research shows. You know, the more help you give to the kids that need it the most, that's where the best investment is. So that is done immediately upon receiving an application. The intake team does a check on the risk factors. And just looking at that, the most common risk factors, obviously low income, family stress, isolation, no opportunity to interact with other children, single parent, and not being able to reach developmental milestones. Here's some more evaluation results. We mentioned that Itasca Community College was a main partner and Bemidji State University was a supporting partner. What we did before the project was even started was the academic dean at Itasca Community College met with Bemidji State University. They set up an articulation agreement so that there was a career ladder in place for anybody interested in pursuing early childhood degrees. So the one-year certificate and the two-year AS degree can be obtained at IS or Itasca Community College, and then they can transfer to BSU and continue their bachelor's degree if needed, or if they want to progress in the program. As you can see, 87 people attending the program. 10 of them are working on their two-year degree, 56 on the CDA, and 19 towards a two-year degree. I have to check that one out. And then there's also the six that have gone even further to either get a BA, a master's, or the parent ed license. Some impacts on our county. I know you've had a lot of stress on early childhood screening. Oops. Trying to make sure the earlier the better. One of our statistics is that at our baseline data said we had 26% being screened early in 03-04. We're now up to 40% doing it before age 4. Another thing we're tracking, out-of-home placement and child abuse and neglect. This year, there were no cases of substantiated child neglect or abuse and no out-of-home placements for any of the Invest Early children. Contrast that to our comparison group that Wilder is following, and there were 4 substantiated cases and 969 days of out-of-home placement. And I think all of you know how costly out-of-home placement is. You can see the savings right there that Invest Early is helping to achieve. The return on investment data for special ed and retention, we don't have the third-year data yet, but in looking back at year 2's data, there was about an $87,000 savings. It was a 9% total decrease in the cost of special ed after 2 years of Invest Early. In retention, there was only about maybe an $8,000 savings in year 2. We'll have to see what year 3 says.
I'm sorry, Ms. Kozak. Could you go back over that? I missed that that savings component in special ed.
Okay.
If you could just
according to the data that Wilder has analyzed, in number of students receiving special ed services, kindergarten through third grade, there were 208 students when we first started tracking, costing $974,196. And after year 2, there were only 170 students receiving special ed, costing $886,521. So a savings, it looks like, of $87,675, so a 9% decrease.
So these were students that actually were on special ed that got off of special ed, or was it?
No, it's really the total cost, and they tracked the schools and all of the costs that were being provided in special ed. And they had the overall cost in the first year, you know, collecting baseline data, and then they had the overall cost of all 4 school districts last year. And then that was the savings. So it's not to say that is there a way of helping me out here?
Mr. Chair?
Come on up here.
Ms. Kozak, would it be fair to say that there was less need or a reduced need for the special ed services? Perhaps somebody who needed a full para, maybe only needed a part-time para, or maybe needed something different?
Yes, and I will.
Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is Jan Reindel, and I'm the director of the Invest Early Project. And so I think what Mary is saying is that, yes, it may have stopped a child from needing special education services once they got to kindergarten. And I think that's truly a big savings.
So the data would actually be reflective of the outcomes of the programs. And, I mean, it's not because there's a different class or different. It's more of a research type data.
Yeah, this is where the data came from Wilder. So when they collected the data on what special education costs were the 2 years prior to Invest Early and what they were spending as districts across Itasca County, and then after 2 years of Invest Early, that number reduced.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the
Senator Saxon.
The Wilder Foundation, as I think Mary said, is in right now is compiling the data on year number three. You know, I don't know how long it's going to be. Probably within a month, isn't it?
Yes.
We'll have that data and we'll get it here. But they have some sneaking suspicions of what it's going to show. But the Wilder Foundation doesn't like to go by sneaking suspicions. So.
And Mr. Chair, I do have a copy of the Wilder research evaluation that has these specific numbers, and I can show it to you, and that might help you see exactly how they're looking at the data and how they're presenting.
That would be important. I think some of the members would be interested in that.
It makes us perk up
because we do spend almost $1 billion in special ed costs, and there's I think it would be much better for the students and much better for the taxpayers if we could find a way that children could avoid that, so
yes,
or preventative. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I did in your earlier part of your presentation, it sounded like does the Wilder have a control group and then a group that's going through? So does this data and the special ed apply to comparisons between a control group and the Invest Early group, or is this just a measure of a progression of years of those children that are in the that are receiving the services and compared with a track record of the past?
Mr. Chair and Senators, thanks. That's an excellent question. And yes, there is a comparison group that Wilder has been studying, and that will be in this March report where they compare the special ed costs of the Invest Early kids to the comparison group. But the numbers I gave you were actually the overall cost from baseline year to now.
Thank you.
Good question, Senator.
And the parent feedback, again, I don't think I need to read all of these to you, but just in glancing over the numbers, you can obviously see that there is tremendous support from the parents. This is an example of classroom quality. They use what's called the Eckers rating scale, the Early Childhood Environmental Rating Scale. And the only reason I put this slide up here, even though it's kind of busy and a little bit hard to read, is to show, if you look at the 3 years, in just about every instance, you know, they make a jump. They climb. Their quality improves. And I wanted to put this up here to show you that when the leadership team gets results, when they get data from their, you know, rankings and from Wilder, et cetera, they don't just stick it on the shelf and let it collect dust. That's the first thing they do is they look at where they need to improve, and then they start working on it. They start putting things into the classrooms or into the curriculum that will help them out. They'll change any training that is currently being done to make sure it addresses the weaknesses. The home learning environment, as I mentioned, there are home visits. So the staff, when they go on these home visits, they complete information on the homes. And, again, there were some improvements on 9 of 15 items that they've been rating. And the most notable improvements, as you can see, mostly relate to literacy, which, as you all know, is absolutely outstanding. Family development and adult basic ed. You can see there's a fair amount of parents that are working with family development staff. They work with them. They set goals. This is how many completed their goals, 57%. Some of them are working on their GED. They're also helped to get employment. I will read you a story in a little bit about a particular parent that took advantage of the family development services. And the parent that Jim Houlihan mentioned yesterday in his legislative summit speech was the person that received the Minnesota Adult Basic Education Outstanding Learner of the Year. We were very, very proud of that. These are the child outcomes being measured by the ounce scale and the work sampling. Ounce scale with 0 to 2, work sampling with 3 to 5. And I think you all have them in your packet, so I'll just keep going. One thing we do want to point out is that ages 4 and 5, particularly the one where it says 77% of the 4 and 5-year-olds showed proficiency in their overall development. That's the all of the domains combined. They started at 44% at the beginning of the year. They ended at 77%. And lastly, there's a quote from Wilder Research. And the thing that probably is going to really grab you is that last thing. Invest early narrows the proficiency gap relative to their higher income peers. So if we can get everybody starting school, you know, at that high level, just imagine the savings.
Ms. Kozak, I'd like to go back to, I guess I don't have page numbers, but it goes back to the out-of-home placement days. And does Wilder have research in that category as well?
Yes, Wilder connects with the county.
Okay.
And gets all of the data straight from the county.
If you could give us, or maybe just give our office that information too, and then we'll share it with the committee members. You probably get the sense that we are looking for ways to save money this year in
right.
particular.
Right.
So.
Okay, in closing, let me just read one letter that is an example of how Invest Early is making a difference and proving that the investment really pays off. We have a file brimming with stories like this one and the one that Jim mentioned yesterday. This is from Lori, who is working with the family support staff for the Invest Early program. She says, "What my position consists of is to help families move out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. I assist families with setting goals, making a plan to meet these goals, finding the necessary resources to meet the goals, and also work with other agencies where families have goals already set. I'd like to give you an example of a family I've worked with for the past 3 years, part of the Invest Early program. Her name is Sarah. She has 3 children, Lyric, 7, Haven, 5, and Quinton, age 2. Haven and Quinton are enrolled in the preschool and toddler rooms. And when I first, this is Sarah, Laura speaking. When I first started working with Sarah, she had no employment, no driver's license, and no vehicle. She was on county assistance, receiving cash assistance, food stamps, and medical assistance. She was struggling to pay her bills and feed her family. The Invest Early program offers extended day, parent education, and adult basic education with families. Sarah began to set goals with our programs to help her family move out of poverty. We've all worked together with Sarah to help her move forward and improve her life. Today, she is off county assistance. She is working full-time and has benefits. She has received her driver's license. She's purchased a vehicle, and she's now enrolled at Itasca Community College. She continues to be involved with our programs and is determined to succeed in life and move completely out of poverty, not only for herself, but for her family. She is very thankful for the Invest Early program. So, yesterday, when we met with a newspaper professional, she exclaimed, "I don't know how else to expound on the pay now or pay later theme. Help me." Well, we think it can be done, and this story is proof. We have concocted a secret sauce that satisfies our communities, and we believe it is possible for others to do the same. The McKnight Foundation and the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundations have 80 communities that are primed and ready to start on their own secret sauce. Major foundations have been working on a business plan. So legislators, could you give me a hand with the missing ingredients?
With what?
Please think of David Lawrence's challenge. about helping Minnesota pay now and not pay later. Thank you so much for your time. And again, I have plenty of people here who can answer any and hopefully all questions that you throw at them.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Saxon.
And I just want to reiterate the fact that Itasca County, although we're lucky enough to have Charles K. Blandon Foundation on site, we also have some of the highest free and reduced lunch in the state of Minnesota. We're in Itasca County, is 2,000 square miles. So when Mary talks about isolation, that's where we come up with isolation. So we don't start with we start with one big advantage in the Blandon Foundation, but a lot of other disadvantages.
Okay, Senator Phoebe.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your great presentation here this morning. My district is just south of the Itasca Mille Lacs County, and we don't have the Blandon Foundation, but we've been very involved with the Initiative Foundation in our own early childhood initiative in the Princeton area and surrounding communities. And something that we struggled with the most, and in your secret sauce, you talked about the one common application. I think my question today would be, how do you get those people that don't ever get to the application, don't ever come through the door, don't find one of the schools, don't have transportation, don't have a phone? That's been some of our struggle, is serving those that truly need to be served and not those that have the wheels or the phone to walk through the door. So any thoughts on that?
Senators, Mr. Chair, Senators, I think what we found is that networking with many agencies, so that you're there in the libraries, you've got connections with social services, you've got connections with public health. We get many referrals, people passing out apps. So it's not just that you come to the school district, because you're right, that just doesn't happen. Even networking through our own early childhood ECFE and school readiness, you see a child that's a baby, and then you know parents' struggles and passing it on. Oftentimes siblings of children that we do serve.
Okay.
Senator Phoebe.
Just, Mr. Chair, one follow-up. You talked a lot about partnerships. Do you have a strong partnership with your local clinic and hospitals? I mean, the public health piece you've mentioned. I know that's been somewhat of a struggle in our community also, that connection with the family practice or the physician assistants that see these children birth to four, sometime the most out of anyone in the community. So I'm wondering how strong your relationship is with your local clinics and hospital.
Mr. Chair, Senators, we have the public health director sits on our leadership team. So she is really our connection. We work with Head Start, also has the doctor clinic sitting on there, some of their committees. They're aware of our project. They have done, passed out also applications. We don't have the clinics on our team. And I'm, you know.
Although I can add, Senator and Mr. Chair, that I'm on the hospital board, so there is a little bit of a connection.
There is. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very excited about your program and how you've collaborated and brought all of those different silos together to benefit families. And I'm wondering, I'm a firm believer that it doesn't do you a whole lot of good to put a child into a preschool program if you don't change their home environment, and that the gains that you make are often not sustainable. By the time they reach third or fourth grade, they just vanish if you don't change what's happening in their whole life. And so that's another reason I'm very excited about what you're doing. And do you have any cases where you can't work with the families and you only have the children? And do you see differences in that, or are you always working with the whole family?
Please give your name for the
record. Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm Maureen Rosado with the Head Start. I'm the Head Start Director in Itasca, Wichita County. One, as if you know Head Start, you know that that whole comprehensive piece and the family support piece is very important to us, and that has also a big piece of what we do. So the project actually contracts with our Head Start family support staff to provide services to any families who need that throughout the year. All Head Start families get that, and anybody else that is enrolled in the project, whether they're infant, toddler, or preschool. So, no, it's available for all families who wish to have that additional support.
Senator Wicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For anyone, do you know the percentage of at-risk students, which may not be in poverty, you could be at risk, but those students that are not participating, sort of following up on Senator Fulby's question, but how many or what percentage are not? And I know the challenge is to provide additional ingredients, but it's a voluntary program. And we're also looking at a policy goal, as was mentioned, in the year 2020, that everyone's ready for school. But if you have such a highly motivated collaboration where people are not voluntarily participating, I'd like to get an idea as to what percentage, the number, and any comments you'd like to share.
Senator and Mr. Chair,
Ms. Koza.
When we first started, you know, we looked at our Census Bureau statistics, and we knew we had 492 children ages 0 to 5 living in poverty. We knew exactly how many, you know, Head Start was serving. We kind of projected how many would be signing up for this particular project, and we underestimated. It's almost like they've come out of the woodwork. In fact, I believe there is a waiting list at all four sites, and so the numbers are there, and we're, you know, working like crazy. As you can see, there are 313 being served this year, so we're doing pretty well. But we were almost nervous that we wouldn't have enough kids then for the comparison group if we helped them all. But I'm sorry, I don't have an exact percentage.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I'd add to that. Probably the largest gap is in the infant-toddler group. We have a huge waiting list in infant-toddler. We don't have resources to serve as many infants and toddlers. I think there's about 90 children on our waiting list, and 90% of those kids are at or below the poverty guideline. So that's the biggest factor that we could really beef up in.
Senator Olson.
Could you, thank you, Mr. Chair, and could whoever might have this, what does the population that you are aiming to serve represent in terms of percentage of the whole of that age cohort in your area? Do you understand what I'm asking?
No, not really.
Of your Olson. County and school districts, of the population of 0 to 5 or 0 to 4, whatever you're serving here, in the numbers that you are attempting to serve, you know, you say you're not serving all of them, so I'm kind of taking it. One of the steps is the one that Senator Wicker was asking: what percentage of those that would appear to fit the risk factors are you able to serve, or are coming forward to request service? But then, what does that represent of that area of need or identified need? Of your whole population of the children in that age cohort,
Senator, Mr. Chair, we've never, you know, drilled down to those exact numbers, but I imagine we could if we worked with Wilder in getting
drill up. Mr. Chair, part of the reason, you know, as we talk about this, and it always comes out that, and we heard it yesterday, the importance of serving all children.
Right.
And I think, you know, we'd started out in our early work on this, recognizing that there are a variety of choices and opportunities out within communities for parents to choose the kind of services they feel their children need, and that as Art Rolnick and others have said, that the best investment mm-hmm. is with those that have some high risk factors and whose parents are, for one reason or another, not able to access or provide. And as you've, I think, shown, that many of them, when they see that they are available,
will take advantage of them.
Yes.
It isn't that you have to drag them kicking, screaming to right. participate in things that may be beneficial to the children. So, you know, our vocabulary and how we do, you know, how we look at it, we have essentially said that we were going to try to serve the at-risk. But we tend to use this, you know, all children should be ready. We're, you know, we get that thing muddled, and we kind of create some of the challenges for ourselves because there are families that don't necessarily need it. And if you extrapolate the cost to everybody, it's out of reach.
Right.
So, plus the other issue, I don't know what kind of services or what kind of opportunities there are in your area in terms of private family daycare, preschools that churches and others may have. Are they in existence too that people children and families are participating in?
Senator and Mr. Chair, yes, there are the private, you know, daycares and the faith-based cares, et cetera, and the licensed family child care providers. And yes, they're all, you know, being used quite heavily. In answer to your first question, I mean, I would dare to say we're serving 50% to 70% of the population that is really in need.
At risk. Okay.
Yes, at risk.
50% to 70%.
I'm daring to say question. That, but I put a note to myself to work on getting that percentage. Okay. I mean, getting a much more accurate.
Thank you,
Ms. Kozak. Could you? And I know in the information here we don't have any cost item, but do you have an idea of like what kind of a investment is per child, kind
yes.
of on an average?
Yes, and I'll turn that over to Jan.
Mr. Chair, Mr. and Senators, we brought our 2007-2008 kind of cost per child, and I have a sheet that I can pass out to each of you.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really am impressed, as everyone is, with the findings, and the Wilder research component is very helpful, and all of us I know on the division are very driven by evaluations, results, and good evidence for the limited dollars we invest. On that point, students now, including many preschoolers, are given a number. It's in the MARS. It's a MARS system for Minnesota Accounting Reporting System for students. And I'm wondering, are students in your system a part of that, assigned a MARS number, so that when we talk about the cost benefit as to not having to spend as much for special ed later, not having as much need for remediation later, that's when we say we're going to have students ready for kindergarten, we can actually measure that when they're in school, but you have to have a MARS number. Are you a part of that system, and if not, why?
Mr. Chair and Senators, we are a part of the system. Each child that is enrolled in our project is assigned a MARS number, and that's how we use to track data through Wilder, and they work with the school districts to track those children. So
great.
In fact, I did bring Mr. Chair and Senators, I brought the whole portfolio from our data tracker, which has all of the forms in that, and there is one thing in there that would show how every single student, I wouldn't want to copy it for you because it is private data, but it shows how every single child, there's their MARS number right next to their name.
Okay, great. Any other questions that members have? Senator Roblin?
Mr. Chair, are you done with your presentation? Because I was flipping
Thanks.
Ahead.
Yes.
And I didn't see them up. I'm wondering about where it says child outcomes, and they have the 0 to 2 and the age 3 years, because the age 3, are these when the children come into the program, or is this after you've had them in the program for a while? Because I guess 29% showed proficiency in their overall development.
It's not great.
That's when they're done with the program, or is that when they're coming in? I'm confused about that.
Okay.
Ms. Rendell?
Mr. Chair and Senators, the 0 to 2 project is very small. You know, we have infant toddler classes across our county, and when we hit the three-year-old is when we blend with Head Start, and the numbers of our children double. We have 210 preschool-age children, but we only have 68 infant toddlers. So oftentimes what you're getting at 3 years old is the child who's – it's their first experience. They're at an entry level at three. You'll have some that have been coming from that 0 to 2 and will be moving through from 0 all the way through 5, but you have a great deal more children coming into the project for the first time at 3 years old.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So, when are the children tested to show these results at the age 3?
Work sampling starts right from the very beginning at entry, and then they put in their first data. So if a child enters at September, the first data collection is in October, and they'll do an assessment. I mean, they do that right then.
But she's wondering if this is after.
I'll attempt to answer that question, Mr. Chair and Senator. These three-year-old statistics are measuring kids that on proficiency to enter kindergarten. So, of course, a three-year-old, they have a whole nother year before. So when you look at the four-year-old data, the 77% or whatever, that's the data that we're looking at. So a three-year-old's obviously not going to be ready to enter kindergarten because they have two more years of growth. Does that help clarify?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman?
That does help. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Could you, to that point, could you pick one of those areas that you are measuring and tracking and explain it a little bit more as to how at 3 years old that you, what is it you look for and how do you determine that where they rank or rate or whatever, however you do it, and then how do you measure and what kind of evidence or how do you do it? Because at 3 years old, we're not, most of us are thinking in terms of assessments that at school age, which is quite different. So help me understand a little more with a little more specificity as to how you do that.
Ms. Rendell.
Mr. Chair and Senators, we use the work sampling assessment system, which is a tool that's used observation, a portfolio system, so that when you provide opportunities for children, you're capturing or you're seeing what they do and by looking at the things they do. Say if say we were building with blocks and you're watching to see the child who can build up. Build out and build a base and build up. That's a different skill level than the child who just builds and builds to the side. And so you look at those, you make observations on those, you'll write notes, and then you go back to your work sampling, our checklist, and you take that information and you gauge where that child is in terms of the skill that's listed. You make the judgment that they're proficient at that skill, they're in process in that skill, or they're not yet there. And it's based on what a three-year-old should be doing. So we're looking at kids that it's developmentally appropriate, you know, the skills that we're looking at, but all kids, as we know, you know, are from here to here on the spectrum and the experiences that they had. Have I answered your question?
Well, I think that Mr. Chairman, so is there kind of instruction along these lines of showing them how to do it and seeing whether they grasp and continue to progress, or is this just watching what their innate skills, curiosity and experimentation would cause them to do?
And it's providing the experiences so that they can expand.
Okay.
What they're doing. So kids learn certainly by the instructor teaching and setting up experiences. They also learn from their peers so much. I'm watching this child and they're doing that. That's something maybe I'll try, and it's bringing them to that next step. So it's a combination. And also I should mention that each child also has an individual learning plan. You sit down with that parent at the first thing and you set goals for that parent, and you're constantly reviewing to see where that child is and where we can help and support them and how we tie that in with the family environment.
And Mr. Chair and Senator, it's important to note that this whole assessment process is an ongoing one. It's not just a one-shot,
right.
You know, here's the test, I'm going to check this child out and then grade them. It is ongoing. They're taking notes all the time on their progress before they actually rate them.
Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully, I won't have made this too disjointed by now, because I was going back to a couple of earlier questions and points. One is, do you know what the percentage of Head Start eligible kids are being able to participate in one of these initiatives? Because when that goes back to the need and need kids that have needs, I think that actually helps.
Senator and Mr. Chair, in our blended classrooms, when we talked about the common application, all of the Head Start eligible children are placed first into this initiative. So every Head Start eligible child we have in our county that we've found are receiving the services with the preschool program. Again, with the infant toddler program, we're missing a lot. Almost every child that's enrolled in the infant toddler with Invest Early are Head Start income eligible children.
So then when we're looking, Mr. Chair, and members, at the need, and if you're reaching the need, it sounds like on the preschool component, you're reaching close to 100% of all of the kids who would be below 100% of poverty and or either in foster care or have some other significant needs, which I think that's helpful for us to know. So when you're talking about looking at other at-risk, when you're talking about that 50 to 70%, Ms. Kozak, that's additional people that would be over. And obviously, families that are 110, 20, 30, 40% of poverty are still struggling to mm-hmm. make it, may have some risks there. The other thing that I think would be helpful for myself and for committee members is to talk a little bit more about the cost. So for the Head Start eligible kids, are they all getting the rest of the Head Start services with that? Is that including the cost? Is this half day, full day, all year, part year? And I know Ms. Stoney is going to talk a little bit about layering of funds. So it might be helpful to be talking about how perhaps any extended day relates to these costs.
Ms. Lozada?
Yes, Senator and Mr. Chair. This project follows the Head Start performance standards. That was one of the things that in the initial development of this, with Head Start dollars being used, we needed to make sure that we are following those performance standards. So every child that's within this project in the preschool portion is getting every service that is required and by the Head Start program. My train of thought here. But
so the costs would include
the cost
all of
per child. Yes, and one of the benefits of being part of this project is that we, as lost a lot of funding in the Head Start over the years, had to reduce services. We no longer have transportation. We're able to provide full day. We provide a six-hour day as our programming portion of all these blended classrooms. So 6 hours a day is considered the programming piece. The time before and after is the wraparound services. Children can receive the transportation and the wraparound services on a first-come, first-served basis, no matter which funding stream is paying for that slot. When we first started, it was an interesting thing because we had people saying, I don't want Head Start because you don't have transportation or wraparound child care. So that's when we had to make a quick turnaround and do the common application and say, okay, we're going to do the common application. We're going to put people in where they fit. And after that, those services go to the ones that need it the most, and we kind of figure that out. We find out who needs transportation. We do have 7 other Head Start classrooms that aren't within the project, and so in Grand Rapids, we try to put the ones that need transportation in the blended sites. So we kind of work that way by family need so that they get all the services. And the cost per child we've seen is about a little bit higher than what we get for Head Start to provide all of the additional services that we get with the project.
Senator Clark.
And Mr. Chair, so 6 hours a day is a little longer than what a regular Head Start service would be anyway, so that could also account for the additional cost. Is this 9 months, more than 9 months? What happens with the kids? I just think it's helpful for members
to have
a better idea about what we're talking about.
Yeah, our Head Start program has for many years provided a 6 hour a day, so we've just chosen that.
Yes, because I know that you guys provide longer days. That's
yes,
good.
We do a 6 hour day, and we're the intensity piece, it's been a choice of our program. But we run, some children go 9 months, and then there is a cohort, one at each county, that runs 12 months. And again, that's done on a as-needed basis. So there would be need for more 12-month programming, but not significantly, because mm-hmm. some families choose to keep their kids home. Their siblings are home. So there is an opportunity for those who really need it to have the 12-month.
So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify that, 5 days a week?
Yes.
Okay, so 5 days?
4 days a week.
4 day a week programming.
4 day a week programming.
And there's wraparound childcare services available the fifth day.
And then wraparound services are available before
six
and
in the
after
morning and until six at night.
For what parents need. So it sounds like then what you're really trying to do is make the service available depending upon what the family, what the parents determine are their needs.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Any other questions? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wanted just to go back. Senator Olson was talking a little bit about these outcomes, and that was something that also in your presentation I was curious about. And I'm not sure that I'm getting this, frankly, to be honest with you. You list for various age groups different kinds of proficiency levels, and for example, age 0 to 2, 80% in mathematical cognitive thinking, 75% proficient in language and literacy, 67% in personal and social development. How do you determine these things? And Senator Olson was asking that. And who set the standards? How do we know what a 2-year-old or a 1-year-old should be doing in language and literacy, and what's the norm? I would imagine there's great variation. I have a granddaughter who's 1-year-old. I guess I couldn't tell you at all how she would score in any of these things. Or how you'd even assess that.
Senator,
I'm curious about how useful this is and whether this is prone to some very, very subjective kinds of evaluations that may have very little attachment to any meaningful data.
Mr. Chair and Senators.
Senator Hand, I think you're here. The one thought that I had, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but was on kind of in the center of this booklet here, where it said that I think this was in a 2-year period, they saved 969 days of out-of-home placement and had, according to the Wilder study, saved I think it was about 100. No, anyway, there was a significant special education cost. So I kind of backed into it, thinking that, not sure how, you know, exactly how you check the maturity or growth or kind of the questions that you're getting at. I kind of backed into it from savings in out-of-home placements and savings in special ed costs were good, in that most counties and most school districts would see that as a real plus, and most families, I think. But that's how I kind of I don't know, and I don't know who wants to field Senator Hand's question, but.
Oh,
please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is Sue Haft, and I'm the Director of Community Education for Itasca Area Schools, the 4 Itasca County School Districts. And the assessment that we use is work sampling in the ounce scale. The framework that we use are the Minnesota Early Learning Standards, and those early learning standards go from birth through age 5. And those are very specific developmental stages that infants, toddlers, and preschoolers all go through, all move through and in their development. The work sampling and ounce scale are observation-based checklists that chart their development. Just like when you had a child of your own, maybe you had a developmental chart that the doctor gave you, maybe not, but and there are very clear guidelines as to how you do that. It's research-based. Samuel Meisels developed ounce scale and work sampling, so it's normed, referenced. You know, it's a very reliable assessment that's used with the children. And the staff are trained thoroughly, very thoroughly, on how to use the assessment tool.
And
that help?
Mr. Chairman,
bit?
And thank you for that. I don't know if it helps or not. I know when we get into higher grade levels in education, we spend a lot of time talking about assessment and testing and how we're testing, how we know that what we're testing is connected to the skills that are being taught and all that kind of thing, and it's very complex. And I understand that it's difficult to do that when you're talking about 18-year-olds and 15-year-olds. And but when you're talking about 2-year-olds and 1-year-olds, and you're talking about skills that to me it's suspicious to be able to have people say with precision that a group of kids, you know, 67% of them at age 1 or 2 are proficient in personal and social development based on what? I don't know. And so my point is, from what I know of how we do assessment at later grades, I'm having a hard time making sense of this as anything other than a fairly subjective evaluation that could be based on lots of things. I know parents, we have kids, and you look at them and you make some judgment about them, but it's not very scientific. And it's really based on what you know about the kid and what you think they need, and you do things in response to that. And that's my struggle with this, is if we're trying to quantify and do this, I'm just not confident highly that we can do that with great precision.
Senator and Mr. Chair, we definitely could show you very specific. I looked in the forms manual quickly to see if we had some of the checklists and could show you those. We don't have them with, I don't think, unless they're in Mary's briefcase. But we could certainly get those to you, and then you would be able to see visually what not proficient looks like when you're looking at a child's development, what proficient looks like. And it is very research-based and scientific as to how children develop. There's been a lot of advances in the last 10 years in particular in brain development and early childhood development and monitoring and assessing that child's development.
Senator Hand's going to do that homework. and as a grandparent also involved in looking at the assessments for grandchildren, I find it just very helpful with the 2- and 3-year-old grandchildren, and I'm very impressed with, you know, the scientific-based research that will, you know, catch things. And so hopefully that will be helpful. Senator Clark, and then we're going to need to go to the next
Mr. Chair, I was going to say, Ms. Stoney may actually have some things to offer as well, and I know we can't get her back after today, but I was thinking that maybe for us sitting around the table, sometimes the word proficient could be a little challenging when you're talking about a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old, because we tend to think about MCA tests and all of that, and that's not what you're looking at. You're looking at what's within the developmental norms. Where are people at? So, I mean, I think for us it's important that we're not assessments and proficient doesn't mean the same thing as we might be thinking of. And I do remember that when on the federal level for Head Start at one point when they were doing the pre-literacy, that there were some things that were just totally inappropriate they got rid of. At one point, one of the things that was on there was the word savanna. Well, I'm sorry, I don't know that many kids in Minnesota even know what the word savanna was, but this was something that, shall we say, a bipartisan, broadly philosophical group had somehow come up with at one point, and they got rid of it because that wasn't appropriate for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old to know, unless you lived in a savanna, perhaps, and had a highly educated parent that was going to talk about it. So, I mean, that's part of what you're talking about, that we've learned things over time, and so we're trying to make sure that this is about giving parents good information and not about creating super science babies or any of that kind of stuff.
Nope.
Right?
Thank you to everyone. What an impressive story you've shared. Sandra Saxog, thanks again. We'll look forward to continued reports. I see there in March there will be a return on investment report on aspects of your program as well. We'll find that very helpful as we develop our own recommendations. Senator Clark.
Thank you very much.
Senate File 72. And members, I believe it's not our intent. We won't act on it today. Is that correct, Senator Clark?
Mr. Chair, I believe we're going to lay it over for consideration as we keep working on putting our bill together.
Okay. Senator
because
Clark.
Because we do know we've got more work to do. I'm just trying to figure out how to turn this off. Oops, no, I don't want to. Okay, I might have made a mistake. It's coming on.
I don't think you did.
I just made it up.
Did I do something?
I just wish. Sister doesn't.
Ms. Stoney, when do you have to leave? We want to make sure.
I'm fine for today. I mean, I'm leaving Saturday morning, so I'm here for the
stay
rest of
focused
the week,
here. So, okay, Senator Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, while we're figuring out how to undo the damage I did by pushing the power button, Senator Saxhog and the folks from Grand Rapids and Blandon really have set this up nicely because between that and what those of us were able to participate in the summit yesterday heard, that's what this is really all about. The Senate File 72 is the work of the Early Childhood Caucus. We've had a bipartisan, bicameral group working on the concept of how are we making sure that all of our kids are ready for kindergarten, and particularly focusing on at-risk kids. How do we make sure that we're getting more accountability into our system, building off the research, making sure that parents are always the drivers, parents have good information, parents are the ones that are making the decisions. And as a state that has the highest percentage of working moms, we know in our state that frankly, that kids are getting their preschool, getting information largely through childcare. It isn't just about our school-based programs. It could be in a variety of different settings, and indeed it is. And we have some places that have got great quality and some that don't. And so what we are working on off of today, and I'm just going to say a couple more things, and I'll come back to it after Ms. Stoney gets done, is that we have been starting to test the concept of a quality rating, an improvement system. It was part of the bill that we did a couple years ago. So it's being tested in conjunction with the MELF and McKnight and others in St. Paul, in Hennepin County, in Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. And the McKnight Foundation, through MELF, is right now investing about $3.7 million on this. So I think,
excuse me, Senator Clark, for our television audience, if anytime there's an acronym.
You're right, Mr. Chair. Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which is whose board is a number of significant business people who have come together off of the work that Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve has done about early childhood, when done right, can be the best economic development tool that the state can invest in. So it's a combination of us making good, sound financial decisions, giving parents good decision-making tools, and making sure that our services, that we've got a lot of great ones, can build on higher quality. As David Lawrence, our keynote, said yesterday, though, this is not about creating a nanny state. This isn't about communism or socialism. This is really about making sure that the services that are out there, that we as public stewards are ensuring that there are appropriate resources at the right level and that parents are able to make good decisions. So I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Stoney, and then when she gets done, we'll talk a little bit more about kind of where we're at. And I know we've got a couple people want to talk about this, but we're just starting the conversation today.
Welcome, Ms. Stoney.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Louise.
Align the mic.
Thank you. Is that better?
Thank you.
Let's see if we can do it. How about that? Is that better? Great. Mr. Chair, senators, thank you very much for inviting me to be here. My name is Louise Stoney. I'm an independent consultant specializing in early care and education policy and finance. In the testimony that I've submitted to you, I've given you more details about my bio. I wear many hats and work for a number of different organizations. I've worked for the past 30 years in close to 35 states, most major cities, with the Cherokee Nation, helping to work on policy and finance issues. I also work co-direct a project at Cornell University with Dr. Mildred Warner called Linking Economic Development and Childcare. I've founded an organization called the Alliance for Early Childhood Finance. So I've worked very extensively on these issues.
I came to work in Minnesota a little over a year ago when I was asked to be the McAvoy lecturer for the university. And at that time, the Legislative Caucus, Early Childhood Caucus, asked me if I would come meet with them. I was then asked to come back again for a family impact seminar, and also spoke to many of you in the legislature at that point. And at that point, the Legislative Caucus asked me if I would come back and spend several days with them in a retreat, helping them to forge an agreement to see if they could work on a bipartisan, bicameral agenda. And so that's very much what I'm going to talk to you about today, and that's what this bill is about. At that retreat, the caucus forged a vision. This is the vision. You have a copy of it also in the testimony that they agreed to. Essentially, what they agreed to work on was a system-wide early care and education standards-based system. It's House File 40, Senate File 72 lays out that vision. You may wonder why I'm here testifying over a vision. Why am I so excited about a bill that's about a vision? It's because leadership is key. What Minnesota needs, what this nation needs right now, more than anything, is leadership. What you heard yesterday from David Lawrence and from Jim Houlihan about what's happened in both Miami and in Itasca County. How do I say that? Itasca County?
Itasca.
Thank you. Help me. I'm not from Minnesota. Itasca. Was clearly, leadership absolutely underscored what was going on there. So what I want to talk to you about is the conditions that you can create here at a state policy level that enable those kinds of things to happen in communities throughout Minnesota. I'm not going to belabor all of the details about quality. You heard in much detail directly from a program today. You heard a lot more yesterday. And you've heard, there are many leaders in Minnesota that have worked for a long time on quality issues. I'm going to underscore one key issue, and that is that high quality matters. It's not just any early care and education that's going to produce results. It's high quality. So what we're talking about today is a high quality and accountability for high quality, and how do we create those conditions. What the research tells us is that there are key principal elements of high quality, and these are bulleted here. There are many different ways to get to those results. It's not one specific program. It's not one specific curricula. It's these conditions. So what we're talking about is a system that can embrace these conditions and ensure that you have accountability across all of your systems, but also give programs the flexibility to be able to adapt to the unique needs of the children and the families in their communities. The other thing that's really important is, and that what science has underscored, all of the science of child development, the picture that you see is a lot of my work I'm drawing from Dr. Jack Shonkoff at Harvard University, who has pulled together a national panel of researchers that are looking at this. And one of the things that they've underscored again and again is that the core concepts of neuroscience, what we know can be effective with children, is not unique to a particular setting, to a particular program. It's possible in all settings. The issue is making sure that we have quality standards and accountability that apply to all settings so that we can get those kinds of results. Why this is tricky in early care and education is because we have a very diverse system. Here's a picture of all the different players that are involved in early care and education. And in Minnesota and throughout the United States, you have public and private providers. You've got homes. You've got center-based communities, schools, all these different settings. You've also got multiple funding streams. And each one of those funding streams typically has its own rules, its own regulations, its own paperwork. And so all these different systems get tied to a funding stream. And I call it the hardening of the categories, this rigid system that then becomes silos, that becomes very difficult to navigate. We just heard from an absolutely wonderful program that is blending funds. What they didn't tell you is how hard it is for them to navigate. They're navigating multiple standards. They're filling out multiple forms. They've got people in offices that, in my personal opinion, are wasting a lot of time having to comply with all these different rules. We can do better than that. We can create a system that makes sense, an umbrella that works, that's much more simple, and that makes sense, and that brings all these folks together. The other sad story is, in many communities, there's not necessarily the kind of partnership. The other thing you heard them talk about was partnerships. Key. If we absolutely have to bring these players together. When they're all in different silos, in different systems, they fight with each other all too often over resources rather than coming together to collaborate. So we need to create the conditions that encourage collaboration. So separate silos, it encourages competition, it makes collaboration difficult, it discourages providers from tapping all the funding streams. I found myself, by the way, sitting in the audience thinking, oh, are they tapping this fund and this fund and this fund? Gee, you could be adding. But, of course, I knew how complex that would be, how you would have to figure out more rules. We want to make it possible for programs to tap every funding stream that's possible. Bottom line, good results come from a sustained, collaborative, system-wide approach to ECE. That's my phrase for what they just said, the secret sauce. We can create a statewide way to make that easy for programs, and that's by creating a big tent with standards that are framed as a big tent so that everybody's moving in the same direction. I want to pause for a minute now and talk about a part of the system that you probably don't talk about or think about too much, and that's parents. In this pie chart here, I'm looking at the money, because that's what I do. I mostly deal with the money. So I'm going to talk about this from the perspective that I often look at it, and that's from the money. And if you take the money that's in early care and education, writ large, this is national data, and you boil it all down, about 39% of the money in the system is government. About 4% comes from the private sector, and about 57% comes out of the pockets of parents. What does that mean? That means that if you want to have real change for kids, real change for Minnesota, those parents have got to be part of the system. Their dollars, their decisions, their choices are key. And we tend to focus all of our energy just on the government slice of the pie. I'm saying that we have to have a system, and we have to think about this in a way that embraces and involves these parents and involves them with their money as well. This is even more important in Minnesota. This is data from some of your research. And it's showing that in Minnesota, 80% of the revenues are coming from families. So you're above the national average in terms of the amount of dollars that are in the system that are driven by private consumers. The other really important reason to think about standards that cross all systems is that remember that families are out there finding services for children of all ages, and often they're getting multiple settings. These are also Minnesota data that are showing the numbers of children. This is a single child that's in multiple early childhood settings at one period of time. So the bottom line is, families are navigating a complex system, and they're navigating a complex system for multiple children, and they're using multiple settings. Again, another reason why we need to break down these silos. So now let me talk to you about a tool that can help you begin to break down these silos, and that's quality rating and improvement systems. And that's a big part of what I've been working with the caucus on. So what's a quality rating and improvement system? It's a standards-based system that makes sense to consumers. That's one of the key things. Quality rating systems take a lot of complex research. All that stuff that you guys were trying to figure out when you were asking these questions of the folks here, what quality rating systems have been able to do is boil that down and basically array it in tiers, 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4, in layers of complexity, so that for consumers, they just have to count the stars. It's a very simple, accessible, user-friendly system. Again, because it arrays standards in tiers, it allows for continuous quality improvement. It's a big tent. Pretty much everybody can fit into that system at one of the tiers, and pretty much everybody can move to get better as they move up the tiers. So it's a system that embraces lots of people. As we said over and over again, it's research-based. One of the things that I like about quality rating systems is that it focuses on what early care and education providers have in common, not what divides them. All too often, standards are focused on what's different. I'm better than you because I meet this standard. I'm better than, and we get into this quality rating and improvement systems embrace all the standards into an umbrella. It's a national movement and a very fast-growing national movement. It started a little over 10 years ago, and in the last 10 years, just about every state has either established a quality rating system, is piloting one, or is studying it. In fact, to give you numbers, 18 states now have statewide quality rating systems. There are at least eight more that are piloting. About 26 states are exploring or planning. And then there are also cities. You heard David Lawrence talk about Miami. Miami is bigger than some of the states I work with. Los Angeles, another citywide system. So this is a very large and national movement. The good news for that is there's a whole body of knowledge that you can learn from. You're not starting from zero. I'm able to bring to the caucus lessons from lots of other states about how to do this and how to do it well. To just give you a little snippet of how quality rating and improvement systems work, which may address some of the issues that came up earlier in your discussions, quality rating and improvement systems embody three different things. Standards for programs, so that programs understand what they need to know and do in order to have good results for kids. Standards for practitioners, that's teachers, caregivers, other, so that they understand what they need to know, guided by outcomes for children. So in other words, you're using the outcomes for children to decide whether the inputs make sense, so that people then can begin to understand it's not random. The outcomes are guiding and helping to inform the decision-making about the standards. The other thing that I love about quality rating and improvement systems and standards-based design is that it's also a framework for true system reform. Again, remember, I'm the money person. I'm trying to make sense out of this money. One of the problems is that the money is like spaghetti. I'm sure you must feel this too. There's this money over here and that money over here and this piece and that piece. What a quality rating system does is allow somebody like me to come in and say, okay, and let me walk you through this picture. If you have your quality standards up here in the corner, your common set of standards that all these funding streams link to, then I can then begin to say, okay, all the different supports that we have, and what do I mean by supports? I mean the training that you give to teachers in all your different systems, the technical assistance you give to your programs in all your different systems, the professional development, the Head Start TNTA system, the kind of things that, again, you heard that in Grand Rapids they were bringing together. You can begin to think about how do you bring that together statewide, because you're saying to all of them, focus on meeting these quality standards. You've all agreed to the quality standards. You can then make sense of the supports. It's not random. We're not shooting in the dark, just spewing out money to improve things without having a really clear sense of goals. Another thing you can do, which I like because I'm a money person, is begin to make sense of monitoring. You know, you can begin in states that are, this is a later stage development, but states that have more advanced quality rating systems are now not having each funding stream monitor and spending that admin money for each thing. They're able to say, wait a minute, we're all working on a set of common standards. Let's coordinate our monitoring so that we're having one set of forms and one set of visits and one set of, and we're begin, or we're collaborating. We'll monitor this, you monitor that. Financing. When you move down to the financing, what you can begin to do, again, is to have synergy with your money. Your money will be moving in the same direction because you're all working on a common set of standards. You can help programs layer, and I'll talk about that in a minute, layer funding from multiple funding streams. And then engagement and outreach. As I talked before, it's absolutely crucial that we get families on board with us. We need a system that makes sense to them. We need a system that makes sense to providers and brings them together in one tent, moving, not competing with each other for scarce resources. Let me talk just a little bit more about the financing box, because this trips people up too. We get very stuck in the financing box with how dollars flow. And some of us are in the corner of portable subsidies, dollars that might follow a family to whatever program they choose. And you have many of those right here in Minnesota. Your CCAP, I don't even know what CCAP stands for in Minnesota. I'm not supposed to use an acronym.
Child Care Assistance Program.
Thank you. Your Child Care Assistance Program, which is your federal Child Care and Development Fund dollars and your state Child Care Subsidy dollars. your pre-K allowances, private scholarships, tax credits. Those are all portable subsidies. You also have direct program support. That would be your Head Start dollars, your school readiness dollars, any early care and education quality grants you have. I can link all of those to your quality standards, and we can create a map that makes sense so that programs can easily blend and layer those. It doesn't matter. So I don't think you need to feel like this has to be linked to one particular way or another. I frequently say to people, and this picture will show you, you give me a funding stream, and I'll figure out how to finance early care and education with it. I have worked with funding streams from all sorts of different departments, all sorts of different agencies. What I need to be effective is what's in the middle of this box, which is that all those different funding streams agree to a set of common standards. But if you can have the common standards at the core, then you can move out from that and begin to make sense of a lot of your different funding streams. This is just a quick picture for you to give you a sense of how that layering works for children with families from different income levels. So this is actually a picture that I created for the state of Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania is doing this work, and they've had a quality rating system and a statewide standards-based system for a long time. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Not a long time. They've actually been doing this for about 4 years now. But in that state, if you look on your right, this bar chart shows a program that's serving 10% subsidy enrollment. Basically, what we want for children is for them to be in settings where you have mixed socioeconomic. So basically, this would be a center where you had some poor kids, many kids that were moderate income or upper income. In that case, that program is probably getting 65% of its money from parent fees, and the rest would be layered funding from other funding sources. A bar chart on the other side shows a program that's serving many poor children. They might be only getting 15% from tuition and the rest from. But the thing that's important is both of these programs are meeting the same quality standards. Both of these programs are moving in the same direction. We can feel confident that we're getting good results from both of these programs, and they're maximizing the funds from all available resources.
Okay.
So in summary, what I'm suggesting here is that you really focus on a big tent, you focus on a long-term strategy, and you really try to bring these pieces together. Now, I've laid this out so that it's very logical, it seems very simple. I don't want to kid you. This is not simple, and it's not easy. And so I want to really encourage you. You got to keep your eyes on the prize, and what I mean by that is you got to stay up here. You're going to get sucked down a lot into the minutiae. You're going to be hearing from programs. Part of what happens right now, especially when dollars are limited, is that programs hunker down. They get scared. They hang on to what they have, and they're going to come to you, and they're going to say, don't change anything. I need my separate silo. I need my piece of the pie, and they're scared. It's really, really important to say, wait a minute, we can do this. We need a big tent that includes everybody. We need to keep our eyes on the prize. We need to really think strategically about how do we create a standard-based system that works for everyone in Minnesota. It's easy to get lost in current practice. You are right now testing Parent Aware. That's a quality rating system. That's a really important test. But I want to give you a word of caution. Right now, Parent Aware is in the evaluation and research stage. I do a lot of work with researchers. They are really anal. They don't want you to change anything. Public policy can't be like that. You can't be that rigid, especially if you're going to do a statewide system. So I'm saying to you, you don't want to just wholesale make Parent Aware statewide. What you want to do is learn from Parent Aware, look at Parent Aware, and say, wait a minute, how do we take the principles of Parent Aware and how do we create a standard-based system that includes everybody? Parent Aware will clearly be a big part of it. But you may include the schools in a way that tracks the standards for Parent Aware but has a slightly different way you implement it. You've already figured out in Parent Aware a way to include Head Start that embraces Head Start standards but tracks it a little bit differently. You may extend that with others. So part of what you need to do is to make sure that you figure out a way to bring everybody in. I also want to really, really encourage you. You can do this now, even though dollars are limited. I work with states all over the country. Trust me, nobody's got any money. and many states haven't had money for a while. And they are making progress on this, even with limited dollars. You can build the infrastructure, you can work on making the system, and then slowly over time, as you have dollars, you can link them, you can add them, you can expand it out. So I really encourage you to look at this as an opportunity and to really move ahead, even in these times. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
If I could go ahead and do just a little bit more explanation. We didn't actually talk about what's actually in the bill yet, so let me do that very quickly, and we can start taking questions. We also have, I'm cognizant of time, but Nancy Johnson is here to talk briefly about how this is playing out in Wayzata, because the schools, child care, others are working together through the other component that we've been testing, which is the allowance. So if we could.
Yes, sir. I think it would be good if you can just quickly go through the legislation, and then if there are some others that some members that have questions or some others that would like to testify to get that information, we will not actually take action on the bill itself, because I think your intent was to get it out and so people could present some information, think about it, talk to people, and then we'll come back to it. So,
Mr. Senator Chair, Clark. We were not planning on doing any amendments today, because we are doing a work in progress. Obviously, we're going to want to make sure that it's considered for inclusion in our final bill, but this is a process. And members, we did have a memo that we handed out. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I do want to just make sure that reinforce that Parent Aware right now is an evaluation. It's being tested. Ms. Stoney said doesn't mean it's the be-all and end-all. I can tell you right now there's some school programs that probably didn't get quite the rating that, because of the way the process worked, that we might have thought they would have. That doesn't mean anything else about that system. But you should be aware, if you look on page 2 real quickly, we are doing some things that are cutting edge, and that are things that would be considered as we're moving forward, and things, again, that our bipartisan bicameral group was looking at. We are unique in that we have an outcome goal of getting ready. Children ready for kindergarten. That kind of surprised me. I assumed that would be a goal everywhere. It's designed specifically to help parents in selecting high quality, which means this isn't just for walks or programs or for us. This is for parents. It has a expert review of curriculum and assessment tools as a key component. It's beginning the work on cultural sensitivity and diversity, and I think the people working on this would be the first to say that we got a long ways to go on that, but that's at least a component that we're trying to figure out. It is being linked, as Ms. Stoney was talking about. I don't know if you can go back to the part about the funding, how the portable, the layering. Do the layering, I guess.
That one?
Oh, that works. Is if you think about it right now, because in the three places that I was talking about, allowances are also being tested, and in St. Paul and Northeast Minneapolis, the scholarships that MELF are doing are also being tested. So part of what's happening is you have to be at a certain level of quality. You have to have hit a certain level to be eligible for those funds. We've had, you might remember, the provisional piece to try to help others get ready. So that's in there as well. And it's the other driver here is that it's supposed to be for all programs. So it acknowledges that a kid's a kid's a kid, and it shouldn't matter if it's in a school-based program, a private program, a child care center, a family child care home, that we should want the same outcomes. We should be having different standards ultimately about where we're going, because we want all kids to be ready. So what does the bill do? The bill is actually fairly broad in its configuration on purpose, because we've got two departments that have been working on this right now, and we want to make sure that we're not codifying a specific set of tools, because we know that as we go along there will be some changes. So it establishes an early care and education framework informed by Parent Aware. It won't be Parent Aware. We will use that until they have the next IT, but we will learn from that evaluation. It uses the tool, the framework, to provide accountability for current public funding streams and links all future funding to the framework. So that has the impact of giving us accountability across all public funding streams, child care, Head Start, school readiness programs, etc. And it uses the tool to track statewide progress on getting all children ready for kindergarten. Now, right now, we have a partnership between the two departments, and I'm sure they would say it's not always an easy partnership. But just like we're expecting people on the local levels, local service providers, to work together and figure this out, so too the two departments have been trying to figure out how do we get this aligned with the kindergarten standards, and how do we make sure that we're taking into account some of those other developmental functions. And so to that end, we would hope they would continue doing that. Because I think as the Blandon example gave us, is that part of this is about resources and being smart with the resources. But this is also about communities and people coming together to figure it out. You know, a lot of what's going on in Grand Rapids right now is about people in all the different services having figured out how to bend, work together on what makes the most sense. So those are broadly our goals, and I know that Senator Michel had to step out for a moment, but he will be back, and he's one of the people that has been working on this.
Okay, we have questions, and I think just open it up. Senator Hand, I believe, first, and then Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have a couple of questions maybe for Ms. Stoney initially here, but the work that you're proposing to do, I'm guessing that's something that you're a consultant. What is the cost to the state to have your help to accomplish these things that you've outlined?
There's been no cost to the state.
But if we, Mr. Chairman and Stoney, if we proceed and go forward, what is your typical cost to help us?
Rarely do the states that I work with actually pay me directly from the state.
Okay.
Typically, I'm brought in by a foundation. In this case, I was supported by the United Way. I get funding from the Kellogg Foundation. I get funding from the NEKC Foundation. There are a few rare exceptions where states themselves are able choose to have a very distinct reason to hire me, but typically not.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ms. Loney, for clarifying that. I've got a copy of a RAND research study that it's got a 2008 date on it that talks about the Colorado Qualistar quality rating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, but their conclusion is that that the QRIS used to measure quality in child care centers finds that much work needs to be done before such systems can be confidently designed and implemented at scale. Also, the absence of a strong link between QRIS ratings and improved child outcomes raises the question of whether research and policy should focus on such outcomes or instead emphasize program outputs. And they do say in the summary here that these are consistent with other studies in the field. Is it your position that their conclusions are not correct, because you're presenting a much stronger case for this as being an effective tool to be used?
Senator and members, I actually wrote a piece in rebuttal to that study. I'm actually quite familiar with that study. And that's a perfect example of I made a joke, which was probably inappropriate, about researchers being anal. Researchers need to control things so that they can really look very carefully over time at exactly what happens. Part of what happened in that study was the researchers couldn't control what happened. And in fact, please don't quote me on these, because I'm doing this from memory. I could get you the exact numbers. But a very, very small number of the children they tracked actually stayed in. They looked at these settings only for 2 years, and a very, very small number of the children actually stayed in the settings for the whole 2 years. So they had a tiny sample size. Secondly, they only had about four programs of their entire set that had actually reached the 5 stars over the course of the study. So the bottom line was they did not have the information that they needed to be able to evaluate whether or not this was working from that perspective. They were, however, in my opinion, accurately critical of some of the components of that particular QRIS. That particular QRIS was measuring some things that did not prove to be particularly effective. And I'll give you one example. They were measuring, they had a measure in there of ratios, child ratios. And they actually had people that were going in and spending the time to monitor ratios 4 times a day in a classroom. That's how, you know. And what they discovered was that teachers were moving children around to classrooms to maintain the ratio. What did that do? That disrupted the relationship between the teacher and the child. Well, that's not good for learning. So they learned that some of their stuff was counterintuitive and needed to change.
And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Monahan, in the abstract, it does talk about some of those things. And the conclusion that they reach is that the ability to do these assessments, given the state of how child care and early child education is done, what I thought they were suggesting is that the state of that is such that to do these things with any great degree of confidence is very, very difficult. And there really is not research that would substantiate this approach because of the very things that you're just describing. Now, I don't want to get into the debate about whether, you know, who's got the right research or anything, but I'm just raising that as a concern. I do want to go back to, in your presentation, you had this approach, a slide about separate silos approach, and you had a statement at the bottom that says, results come from a sustained collaborative system-wide approach to ECE. This requires standards framed in a big tent. And my question is, how do we know this? It would seem to me that, and you talked a lot about resources and using them effectively, and there are some of us, and I'm one, I'll frankly admit, that believe that in a competitive environment, that is the most efficient way to direct resources to things that work. And you seem to suggest in your slide that that's not correct and that there's this other approach that is better, but I'm trying to figure out what is the basis for that statement and why are we rejecting an approach that has seemed to be very successful when you're talking about allocation of resources and finding ways to match them up with needs and seeing that the results happen, which is typically in a competitive environment. What's the response, I guess?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Tony.
Senators, I am not at all suggesting that we not focus dollars on what works and that we not have programs, as you would say, compete to meet quality standards. What I'm suggesting is that we have the programs competing with the same quality standards. Right now, what happens is the standards compete, not the programs. Program meets Head Start standards, and they say, I'm better than you who's meeting pre-K standards, and I'm better than you who's meeting school readiness connection standards. That doesn't make sense. So what I'm suggesting is if we have one set of standards and we say we're focusing our dollars on programs that meet those standards, and then within that range, yes, we focus our dollars on, and if you do a quality rating system, actually, and you have programs arrayed 1-star to 5-star, you're able to gear your dollars to programs that are doing the most intensive work with the most difficult children.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Sloney, but that is part of my concern, is who gets to set those standards and why do they get to set them rather than somebody else, and why should those standards be determined by a political process rather than a market process? We don't have standards like this for colleges, for example, or even for public education, frankly. People decide on the basis of what they understand their needs are, and then they go to the degree they're able to direct their resources to meet those needs. I guess what I'm not completely sold on is the idea that we create a committee and give them power to set standards, and then say everybody's got to meet those standards, and if they don't, then they're not eligible or they're not good or they ought to be ostracized in some way or looked down upon or whatever or else they all have to participate. Why is that process better than the way we do this in other kinds of services that are provided?
Senator? Members?
Ms. Stoney?
We do have standards enough. I'm right now looking for a college for my daughter. And I am checking the accreditation of the colleges that I'm working for. So we do have standards for our educational institutions. We do have early learning guidelines for our schools. So I think we do, in fact, have standards for many other systems. I need to say to disagree. However, I want to show you another picture. How do I do this? Because I think there is a point that maybe would be helpful to you. That is this picture. I think it's extremely important to recognize who is choosing to be part of a formal early care and education system and who is not. And what we're talking about here for this standards-based system are early care and education practitioners that are choosing to be part of a formal system. And let me, for a minute, give you an analogy that actually worked very well when I talked to Senator Michelle about it. And I'm going to take you to the agricultural industry for a minute. When I go to my grocery store to buy tomatoes, I know that when I buy tomatoes in that grocery store, they're meeting USDA standards for the way they were grown, and there are standards around pesticides and handling. Okay. I also know that I can buy my tomatoes from my next-door neighbor who has a great farm. But I understand clearly the difference between buying the tomatoes from my next-door neighbor and buying the tomatoes from the store. That's what we're talking about here. I'm not saying that people cannot provide early care and education. So if you look down to the bottom, you see a box that says family, friend, and neighbor providers. That's absolutely a part of the system, and families have the ability to choose that. But I think we need to be clear with consumers that there's a difference between a set of programs that have chosen to meet quality standards and that are working toward being part of a formal early care and education system. I also think we need lots of supports for families, and you heard this when we heard from Grand Rapids. So all of these pieces are part of the bigger system. But what we're talking about here is making sure that right now we're funding, right now we're holding programs accountable for standards. But we got all these different standards. We're saying let's make sense of that.
Mr. Chair. Senator Gerlach.
Do you mind if I just real quickly, two members? I think, you know, part of what we're trying to do here is find pathways, windows in to get new ideas and doors that people can come in to increase their quality. And we have some things, some of our child care dollars right now, on the formal system, all that's required is to be licensed. There is nothing about anything else. And now, that's not to say, I mean, my children were in both an incredible in-home family child care, and they were also in a really great center-based care. They also came with me when they were little. But they, from a parent standpoint, a lot of times those options aren't available, or there's a provider that would really like to gain some more skills that hasn't had that opportunity. I think that Ms. Johnson can speak to that. But what it means is, from a public investment standpoint, we're not necessarily doing anything or saying that we want our dollars to be used to help increase what we know works or be something more than just a safety valve. And the bottom line is, former Senator Piper used to say, all kids are learning. They're learning in whatever environment they are. And today, most kids are in childcare, and that's where they're getting their preschool. Now, we also have a number of kids that are in family, friend, and neighbor care, and it may be that what happens is they go down the street to the local preschool program, whether it's the school or whether it's Head Start or something else, and that's what they get for their portion of the day. And right now, we don't have, as Ms. Stoney was saying, any similarities. The other reason why we're actually asking these questions is goes back to what Dr. Rolnick talks about, is we want to make the best investment. And the best investment in terms of economic development is when you have the at-risk kids that are getting high quality. If they're getting crummy quality, that's not a particularly good investment. So that's partially why we should care about it. And, you know, going back as a consumer, as a parent, I want to know that information. I don't know about you guys. When you're traveling, when I'm traveling, I do actually look at how many stars or diamonds or whatever. What are the amenities a hotel has? What is it there that they offer? Parents ought to be able to have good information so they know what those building blocks are. Obviously, they need to be able to go in and check it out. That's kind of important. But this is a way to make sure that parents can feel comfortable knowing if it's 3 stars, it's going to be at this level. If it's 5 stars, it's at this level. If it's at 1 star, I need to know that.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Stoney, I'm going to take your advice and not get into the weeds too much because it is a lot of detail. But I am looking through this here, and I wanted to ask more of a high-altitude question. Maybe Senator Clark might want to answer this one. And I'm trying to look at this. I get nervous when any proposal comes forth that covers all or umbrella or everything. And the reason is because I believe in that diverse choices and options and things like that are good, because that's where innovation and creativity comes from. And once we gather everything up and hold it tight, we stifle that creativity. We create monopolies and those things. Now, there's a balance point, of course. efficiencies versus trying to avoid STIFAD. And what makes me nervous is I look at it here and I see the vision for early childhood and education in Minnesota, agreements made at the caucus retreat, and that slide was up on the board. And it says the accountability that this QRIS is going to be public and private market programs are high quality, and that exact language is lifted into the bill. And I'm trying to think now, we get into real difficulty when we try to regulate these things. And I'm trying to think of an example. Now, I serve on the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, and we have a public interest in a lot of regulation of business. Take any manufacturing company, let's say whatever it is, we have OSHA standards for safety. We have labor standards. We have health standards if it's producing food. I say they're making frozen pizzas. Okay, but we don't dictate the quality of the product. We don't say that it's in governmental interest to make sure that the crust doesn't taste like cardboard or that the sauce doesn't taste like ketchup. We leave that up to the marketplace. So we have, we cover the safety, those issues, and then we leave the rest of that up. So now the bill here, what's before us, is we're saying that there's a public interest in not only the safety and those sorts of things that parents make decisions on, but now we get into a very difficult subjective area of quality and we're going to now use the power of government to umbrella or grab in all of these, private folks. And that makes me very nervous, and I don't like that. Why is it necessary to branch out and encompass all of these private folks? We don't do that with so many other things. Why are we doing that?
Mr. Chair and Senator?
Yes, Steve.
Who's couple of things I want to underscore. First of all, this is a voluntary system. A quality rating system is voluntary. So programs can choose whether or not they want to participate.
That's important. I appreciate
okay.
that.
Okay. Secondly, what we're talking about is, that's why I put up this slide, principal elements of quality. There are many different ways to achieve highly skilled teachers. There are many different ways, many different approaches to curricula. So the bottom line is it's not prescriptive. In fact, one of the ways that we're learning about doing quality rating systems effectively, and one of the ways that actually Parent Aware is being experimented with here, is with what they call a point system. You have five domains that contribute to quality. In each one of those domains, a program can get points. So a program might be really strong in this area over here and not as strong over there. Another program might be really strong in this area, for example, teacher practitioners, and less strong over here. If you add up the points, both of those programs might have equal stars. So the point is we are, in fact, trying to do just what you described. We are trying to allow programs to have the flexibility so that they can be creative. We're trying to give them the opportunity to be, by not saying this is not a cookie-cutter approach. It's a set of domains. And we're also, but the bottom line is that to be effective, unfortunately, the taste of your pizza and the skill of your early childhood are not equivalent. The skill of an early childhood teacher is crucial for the life success of that child. You can eat a pizza that might taste really bad, but you're still going to get the same kind of, you're going to still get the same nutritional value, if you get any, from a piece of pizza. So I think we have to think differently about how we use quality.
Mr. Chair, just real quick.
Say that we do have session at 11, and I have a couple more people or several more people to testify. So if we could at least get through the testimony for those that have showed up today. And then,
sure. And Mr. Chair, I just had one. I think it is important. We're talking about our public dollar investment, not what somebody's private dollar decisions are. So for our public dollars, we should be expecting something out of it. Otherwise, why are we spending them? So think about, I'll use my area because I know Job Z can be a little bit controversial. In my area with Job Z, we've made sure we have certain wage and benefit levels, among other things. We have criteria because it's public investment. So we want to make sure we're getting some return out of our public dollars. And so I have, and Mr. Chair, I have Ms. Johnson here.
Okay. We do have three people, I believe, that are still left. And yesterday's discussion was on standards and testing, which we were You know, we're working on trying to raise expectations and be, you know, at the secondary level. And so this is interesting. Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. And I'll just take a couple minutes just to say that...
Please give your name for the record.
My name is Nancy Johnson, and I'm directing one of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation pilot programs. Our pilot program is somewhat unique in that we're in one of the more high-income areas of the state. We cover the Wayzata Public School District, which is Wayzata and Plymouth primarily. And the reason I mention that is that, first of all, there are many low-income families in that area. So we are focused in our Caring for Kids initiative on making sure that families who are earning low wages can make good choices for their kids. And the thing that made it very easy for us, we've been now providing scholarships for a little over a year, were a couple of things. One is that we could leverage what already existed in the community. So we're leveraging 10 already quality-rated programs, and part of the reason for that is that in many of the suburban areas, there are a number of very high-quality, good childcare programs, partly because the market demanded them. Parents had the money to pay for high quality and demanded high quality, so the market produced some high quality. It's not quite the same in some other areas of the state. So it's very contextual in that sense. But what we were able to do with our scholarship program is leverage public dollars. We use the child care assistance program. Some of our children get school readiness funds. Some of our children, their families apply for child care tax credits. So all of that is part of the mix. And in addition to that, we're raising the community's acceptance of this issue, understanding of why it's so important, and investment in it. So we're also... raising their interest in the public investment and raising private dollars to wrap around this. All of the families pay something in our model, so up to 10% of their income they're paying for this. Some of them choose private. Some of them choose private programs, as I said. Some of them are choosing the programs that are operated through the public school system. It also allows us to wrap around the private system with the public school so that special ed, social work kinds of needs that the families have get to those families early when their children are young and they can really make a big difference before they're entering kindergarten. So on many levels, the partnership is important, the leveraging of public and private money is important, but all of it depends on all of those programs being high quality. And as part of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation pilot, we're not getting so much money for the scholarships, actually, as Minneapolis and St. Paul, but we are getting the complete and state-of-the-art child assessment that MELF is doing. So we'll be able to look and see how did this do in terms of our goal of having kids ready for kindergarten. So, that.
Just curious... When Blandon gave their presentation, they had like a very comprehensive participation of many, many different partners. Is that occurring out in your area as well?
Mr. Chair and Senators, yes. And I think it's absolutely part of the success component. Actually, we don't call it secret sauce, but I love that. But, you know, families, if you become homeless... Your child might be attending a two-hour-a-day school readiness program, but if the rest of their day is about being a homeless child, that's going to have implications for their development. So one of the things that I think all of the MELF pilots are trying to do is connect up the service for the child with connecting parents with existing services in the community and making sure that they're able to follow through and link up with those, whether those services are in the social sectors or whether they're in the public school systems. So we have a lot of parent education wraparound. We do specific things to make that more accessible to working parents. So, for instance, where an early childhood family education class might have before been offered from, let's say, 9:30 to 11, 2 days a week, it now gets offered in the evening so that working parents can be part of parenting ed. So those are the kinds of partnership things. But the key thing is that wraps around the programming that the parent is able to access for their child.
Thank you. Very good. Is Karen Schaub here? Yes. Would you like to join the group at the front, or?
Good morning. My name is Karen Schaub. I'm the Director of Community Education for the Roseville Area Schools, and I'm also the past president of the Minnesota Community Education Association. And that's the hat that I'm wearing here today. And I'm here to talk about the bill that's in front of you and want to thank you for your support and your willingness to sort of drill down in this topic. As an educator, we feel this is very, very important to have our kids ready for school, and we're really excited about this discussion, even though it's a very difficult discussion, and we all come from some different places. As Minnesota Community Education, we're really interested in having this common dialogue about what those standards are, but we also really want to take a good look about the standards and how they're appropriate to the scope and the nature of multiple options. We want families in our school districts, as they have for past years, to have a variety of different options, and we want to continue to support that. And I believe that you also want to support some different options. It's important for us to have quality. We've always wanted quality in our programs, and we will continue to seek quality. As you've heard this morning, there's also a lot of opportunities to layer. In school districts and school readiness programs, we work on layering all the time. And we are up for that challenge. Our concern continues to be for the highest risk students, those students that need more than maybe 8, 10, the 12, 15 hours a week. That's an area that we really struggle at finding ways to support those children so they are ready to enter kindergarten and they're ready to learn for us. We're excited about going down this road. We're looking at it. We're also, as many of you, I hope, feel, is we want to be careful that we're also not putting unfunded mandates. There are a lot of research that needs to happen to keep these programs strong and going, but we also have a variety of programs right now that rate us or that evaluate us, and we want to make sure that we're not layering more and more research on top of research where we don't have time to take our dollars directly to our young adults. We're here. We want to continue our discussions with you. We want to support what's going on. We've been here in the past to support early childhood. We're here now to support school readiness, and we want to continue our efforts to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Ephraim?
Mr. Chair, while Dr. Ephraim's coming up, I do think it's good to reinforce what Ms. Stoney said earlier, is the goal is actually get rid of some of the red tape, both for parents and providers, and to make sure that there is more consistent requirements or accountability. So the hope would be there would actually be less work than what our great schools are going through when they're trying to layer funds right now.
Dr. Ephraim.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, trained as a pediatrician here on behalf of EdWatch. We have several concerns, not only about this bill, even though it's a work in progress, as well as the whole concept of a statewide quality rating system. First of all, the fact that the bill says all. It says public and private. And it says, and the word voluntary, even if that's the concept, is not anywhere in the bill. Those are huge concerns, especially when you're trying to use basically a statewide set of politically and bureaucratically chosen standards that have never been honestly reviewed by the legislature, as has went through a very long process with the K through 12 standards, with the profile of learning fight, and then the redoing of our standards. The assessment that I'm passing out is the work sampling system, the checklist, used for the kindergarten readiness assessment. It is, as a pediatrician, as a mother, I think these are incredibly vague. They are subjective. They are non-academic. They are inappropriate for the level that they are being used. Such items as shows beginning understanding of numbers and quantity, shows an appreciation for books and reading, shows eagerness and curiosity as a learner, shows empathy and caring for others. Those may be nice goals, but how do you accurately, objectively, or fairly assess them? Tracy Wallace, who is one of the trainers from the Department of Education for implementing this work sampling system in the various programs, who trains teachers to assess the children, said in early childhood committee testimony, "We know that 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds are very poor test takers. You know they have their own agendas, their own personalities, their own timelines, and they don't have the personal skills to sit for testing. And sometimes they lack language skills to truly explain what they know. They also haven't learned the social skills or social rules for test taking. So with any assessment of young children, you have to recognize the limitations of the data we have. With work sampling or other kinds of observational assessments, you might wonder about the quality of the observation that the teacher did. And we might wonder about the conclusions that the teacher inferred from the observations. Are they accurate?" In the publication of the yearly kindergarten readiness assessment, the department itself says, "Because children develop and grow along a continuum with great variability, the goal of these studies is to assess children's proficiency within and across these developmental domains and not establish whether or not children are ready for school with the use of a composite ready or not ready score. Young children develop rapidly and at varying rates across the domains, and an early definitive determination of readiness can have unintended negative consequences. Yet, the kindergarten readiness assessment work sampling system is constantly used by proponents of quality rating, of statewide early childhood, of all of these funding bills that we don't have money to pay for, to say that 50% of our children are not prepared for kindergarten. Actually, the metric that we need to be looking at as a state is not whether children are prepared or not for kindergarten based on a subjective, unreliable, non-academic assessment such as this, but rather how they do in school in the long term. And there are 3 states that have gone through putting in place either universal preschool, being Oklahoma and Georgia, or New Jersey, which has had state required by their Supreme Court preschool for poor children. And we're not talking 200, as in the Blanded study, or 127, as in the Perry Preschool Project. We are talking tens of thousands of children. And these children, after these states have spent billions and billions of dollars on early childhood programs, have not seen any improvement in their fourth grade reading assessments. And in fact, all of them have seen declines. The poor children in New Jersey, which received the targeted preschool that included Head Start, private and public programs, actually had an increase in the number of children that were scoring below basic on reading, on the most fundamental academic skill. They went, so the literacy rates increased, they didn't decrease. We need to consider those kinds of things as we're considering spending this much money.
You have a question, Senator Michelle.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hesitate to interrupt because I know Dr. Ephraim's just getting going. But my sense from some of your materials and from your testimony is that you're kind of laying the groundwork and that you doubt, maybe that's too strong a word. Let me say it this way. We have an embarrassingly high achievement gap in Minnesota. We're all nodding our heads on that. This, an effort, some kind of effort in early childhood is a way to get at that. Are you not in agreement with that general direction, with that general goal that I just laid out? I know you agree with attacking the achievement gap. Are you doubting that the state can do it in this manner and that early childhood can be a part of that? Because I think that's kind of the fundamental, you know, kind of why we're here.
Thank you.
Dr.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, yes, I am doubting that highly. And the evidence that I would use is the study by Dr. William Janes at the University of California, Long Beach, that found, and this is 20,000, again, not a couple hundred, but 20,000 African American and Latino high school students, if they came from two-parent families and had religious involvement in their lives, the achievement gap went away. They had the same test scores as has children that as white children. Now, that's just one. The Pacific Research Institute has found that direct instruction based on academic fundamentals in K through 12 has taken care of the achievement gap. Even Jack Schoenkopf says that there is no neuroscience research that that says that you have to do this before kindergarten, and that it casts doubts on interventions that may be done after the preschool years. There's a professor from the University of Minnesota who said that, again, the brain is not finished with its trajectory even by the end of adolescence. So, you know, there's 600 studies that show that Head Start doesn't work.
Mr. Chair,
Yeah, it is. And isn't it wonderful that we don't have to make the decision
yes.
Today?
Yeah.
But I am cognizant that we do have session at 11, and I do want to point out that I believe on this that you handed out, what are the like the questions will have like a page number after it, and then I saw over here that there must be a description in a booklet or something that's used, we should probably get the full description to go along with this to explain a little bit further what the questions might be.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Senator Michelle.
Yeah, you know, perhaps we can go through and analyze the kindergarten readiness assessment, although I'm not sure that's that big a part of this bill. But one of the points that I'd like to make is kindergarten or first grade is, I've just had too many teachers and parents say it's too late. That it's too late. And so, you know, we can get into a battle of studies. You're going to win on that because you're more well-read. But I've just had too many parents and teachers say, we got to get to them earlier. And now it's got to be a mix of public and private. And maybe we can work on that language here. But I'm so persuaded by the brain research about how important those early years are. And I don't want to pretend that myself or anyone at this table has the answer yet. But the reason for my first question to you was I think you would doubt that there can be any effective kind of government intervention in those years. And, you know, based on Art Rolnick and some of the studies that I've heard and some of the testimony we've received, I'm at another spot. I think we can help, and I think we have to.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you for allowing that, Mr. Chair.
I just want to give the courtesy, Senator Clark, before we have to go upstairs. Maybe you can just give a quick wrap-up. But next Tuesday's hearing is going to be on the QComp report that I believe the legislative auditor has done. And so that'll be presented by the legislative auditor. So Senator Clark, and then we'll have to go.
Thank you. We'll obviously be continuing our work on this. Members, again, the voluntary component, you don't have to be involved in this if you don't want to as provider. But as stewards of public resources, we want to make sure that we're getting the kinds of outcomes that we're looking for. And I will provide some information on the data from some of those states because, for example, in Oklahoma, it is still a relatively new process in terms of statewide, and they've been very impressed with the number of Latino students that have totally closed the achievement gap by kindergarten. And that's, you know, we got to talk about what's happening in kindergarten and first and second and third grade, which is why the reading work is so important. So this is one component, but we'll be looking forward to working with you. And if you have more questions while Ms. Stoney won't be here, we'll be able to get information and bring it back to you.
And I think, speaking for you, Senator Clark, I believe you're open to working with anyone who has discussions, information, whatever.
Exactly. So, and I might say, Mr. Chair, that that's the goal of our bipartisan bicameral caucus, is we want to try to figure out how to do what's going to make sense together. So be talking to members. And
thank you, Dr. Ephraim and Senator Clark and Stoney. Thank you. We'll see you next Tuesday. Committee is adjourned.